Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Today on our show, David Shields is back to talk about his book, War is Beautiful. Author Sam Quinones is here. He's written a new book called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. We're going to listen to a segment of Colin Marshall's interview with some guy from Brooklyn named Jonathan Lethem. Joining me are my co-hosts. He is the founding editor of LARB, Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Seth. Can I just say that this is really just a half-hour show?
But we remain aspirational, do we not?
We do.
I hope so.
And I like the name. It sounds better.
The LARB Radio Hour. There's a gravitas to that I think does not suit us at all, but we're going with it. And she's the fiction editor of LARB. She's a critic. She's written for the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, somewhere in the mists of the past. Lori Weiner is here. Hello, Lori.
Hi. Did we consider calling it the Bell Telephone Hour?
You know, their sponsorship was withdrawn the last minute. I didn't want to bring it up. Oh. It's a sore subject.
Okay. And, all right, but Dinah Shore is not coming in?
Dinah Shore is coming in,
okay.
Actually.
Okay.
And if we get going on the show, we can get her in here sooner rather than later.
Excellent.
3% of our audience is going to really appreciate that Dinah Shore joke.
I think do a Dinah Shore reference whenever you can. The author David Shields was in recently to discuss his new book, That Thing You Do With Your Mouth, which is no longer his new book. He's written another book. It's called War is Beautiful, the New York Times Pictorial Guide to the Glamour of Armed Conflict. David Shields, welcome back to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you so much, Seth and Tom and Lori.
Let's frame it first for the listeners. The book is actually a curated collection of photographs of the Iraq War that appeared on the front page of the New York Times. So do you want to say a few words about that before we jump in?
I think I heard you, but basically it's also about the Afghanistan War, too. It's not just Iraqi War, but
right.
Various sort of Middle East incursions by the U.S. and allied governments. And the book is not a publication, obviously, by the New York Times, but it's a critique of their use of what seemed to me to be highly curated war photography that, as Picasso says, good taste is the enemy of great art, and all of these pictures are guilty of exquisite good taste. And we ended up narrowing it down to 700 photos that struck me in a subjective reading as pictures that have very little interest in conveying the raw, naked horror of war and much more investment in a kind of corporate folk art whose not-so-cryptic message is a sort of subtle endorsement of the war.
I see that very easily in some of the very first shots that are in the book, the kind of desert shots with the tanks going by in this the colors are intense and kind of beautiful. I quite understand the first two pictures in particular. The other photos, I'm just not sure how exactly they make your case. For instance, there's a picture of some very distressed people whose relatives have just died. I'm not sure how that is a case for war.
Right. I mean, that's the one. It's quite, amusing or striking to me that everyone goes to that one picture, like as if that were somehow hugely countervailing evidence. I guess what I would want to say is I'm not really interested in arguing each picture, although if you want to, I can certainly discuss it. I certainly included that picture, but the book is an argument. It's a 64-step argument. You know, you guys know in L.A. that if you write for a TV show, a show has a sort of show Bible. Here, the gestures the characters can make, and here the gestures the characters can't make. And if you're hired to write on the show, you're typically given this huge binder of acceptable gestures. And it seems to me that part of what I'm trying to point out is that the Times has effectively a kind of show Bible. There's only a certain amount of relatively limited and restricted gestures that the Times allows war trauma to take.
Haven't photographers always aestheticized war, though? Admittedly, in these Times pictures, color is a recent addition to newspaper presentation, of course, but it's just part of something that's a continuum of aesthetic photography that goes back to Matthew Brady.
I guess I'd argue against that, namely that for a variety of reasons, that in the hands, in the sort of curated hands of the New York Times, what has been a more visceral tradition of war photography, as we say, going from, say, Matthew Brady through Vietnam, has really eroded. I think of this work as sort of cultural intervention or, you know, an attempt to worry these pictures, to bring intentionality and purpose to what seems to me a kind of empty aestheticism. I mean, I think Dave Hickey's argument lies heavily with the idea of, you know, compositional framing and the beauty and the certain lines. And I'm less worried about that, you know, although that's, I mean, he as an art historian and art critic makes some good points in the afterword of the book, and it's a very interesting afterword. But I'm more struck by the sort of, instead of General Sherman's "War is Hell," to me here, war seems like heck. You know, it seems like, okay, war's kind of bad, but it's also really pretty and sort of necessary. I mean, sounds like some people, you know, don't always agree, but if I can push people to question it, I think that's a positive.
I think your book will do that, and I think it's doing it to us because we're now scouring all the pictures in the New York Times.
Right.
And of course, nobody looks at the front page of the New York Times anymore, because what we're looking at is the digital edition, almost all of us, and that which is, you know, so that gives less real estate value to what's on page one, because that is changing constantly. But for instance, a lot of my knowledge about the suffering of the Syrian refugees has come from pictures that I've seen in the Times and in other places. So I want to be an apologist for the Times, but I do think that I can't help thinking as a journalist that it does do an incredible job of disseminating information.
You know, I mean, obviously, in a way, this book is in a way a reification of the Times as a monument. The book is not about the Kansas City Star or the Des Moines Register or even the Boston Globe or the LA Times. First of all, if you pointed it out about the Wall Street Journal or USA Today or Fox News, it would just be obvious, and it would be congruent with the paper's editorial stance. But the Times was, you know, thought to be or tried to be relatively centrist about the war. They had some confusing, mixed messaging, bad faith contradiction. For instance, look at the paper today, where there was, I believe, some Syrian women who were burying civilian dead, and they were, you know, it looked like a Vogue fashion shoot. You know, four of the most beautiful women on the planet were the designated mourners. And, you know, if this were an exception, be like, okay, that's interesting. Those are four really beautiful women who happen to be burying their Syrian civilian dead. But, you know, I just think it happens time and time and time and time again, in which beauty and war, it ends up, I can't totally unpack the argument, and it's not totally clear to me how conscious the Times is of it, but what kind of message is getting sent by when inevitably the mourners are stunningly beautiful women? It can't help but glamorize, aestheticize, and
I think that
nullify war.
I don't see how you can say it can't help but do X. I mean, even that very first picture in your book, which is very Gerhard Richter looking, I can imagine a veteran, a kind of staunch patriotic veteran, seeing that and seeing the kind of, it could seem glamorous. To me, it's horrifying, and it's depressing, and it's deeply disturbing, that image.
That's fascinating. I mean, to me, that, because I recently visited a law school to talk about some of the issues regarding the book, regarding transformation, appropriation, copyright, trademark, et cetera. And one student, a very interesting law student, had exactly that same reaction. I just think that's fascinating to me, that some people definitely read against my reading, against the images. And I'm not sure what to say other than the book is meant to be problematically beautiful in exactly the same way that New York Times front page pictures are problematically beautiful.
In that, it succeeds. The book is War is Beautiful, the New York Times Pictorial Guide to the Glamour of Armed Conflict. David Shields, thanks for coming back. I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK. Before Colin Marshall left Los Angeles to become the LARB correspondent in Korea...
Among other things.
And we should probably tell the audience that he was the original voice of the LARB podcast.
He was. He's, 60 of them are in the archive.
Well, what he did, Tom and Lori, was he collated some of his favorite interviews for us. And the one we're going to talk about today is... the one he did with Jonathan Lethem.
All of these favorites are about Los Angeles. Jonathan's is kind of about Los Angeles.
It's about Los Angeles and Claremont because, of course, he teaches over there. So it took a while to arrange this Lethem interview. I wanted to talk to him for a while. Knew he was in Southern California, but he was in Germany for a while here, and there's a busy guy. So after a year of arranging, we got it down. And I took the train out there, you know, it's like an hour-long ride, so I was going to get my time's worth. I stayed there in his office for 2 hours, 90 minutes of which are the interview, talked about all kinds of things, you know, his favorite obsessions to his time in Southern California versus New York, and what he thinks of Claremont and the reality space it creates for itself.
I'm definitely a work in progress in terms of, like, having an L.A. sensibility.
I mean, you did set a book here, of course, I'll say that.
I set a book there... in Silver Lake. I'm not saying here because I know better than to act like Claremont is Silver Lake. That's the thing, is I find LA to be very...
Yeah, we're nowhere near Los Angeles right now.
It's very large. It's very distributed. Right. It's very incoherent, and the different parts agitate and vibrate against each other, but they're also really local. And so, you know, my take in progress is that any take would be facile, that the place is really specific. So, like, but that's what it is to care about a place. You don't, if you just think that, like, Brooklyn is cool, you probably don't know Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. You've got to be aware that the place is contradictory and inflected and varied, and Los Angeles seems to me to demand a lot of microscopic work. Now, whether I could ever get into a more, open my pores to the layers, start to see the layers of history and how they stack up to make the present in some segment of a Los Angeles urban setting for a story, a substantial story or series of stories or a novel, I don't know. I'd love to think I'm going to do that, but I'm not sure being out here in Claremont equips me to do that yet.
Right. I guess there's layers here in Claremont too, right? I haven't spent much time here. You spent more.
Claremont's interesting. It's like, there's a street sign. I mean, not a street sign, just literally a sign someone's got on their house, on their porch that says, "You are now entering Bedford Falls." And the thing about Claremont is that it is, you know, on the good days, it's Bedford Falls. On the bad days, it's Stepford.
Oh.
On the really bad days, it's the village from The Prisoner. It's a fantasy of an enclosure where a perfect 1950s suburb can be collectively enacted. And believe me, that's not. I don't mean that only critically or only scoffingly. It's a very seductive, you know, having grown up with the fantasy through watching, you know, Douglas Sirk movies and Twilight Zone episodes and. Sure. Reading John Carver and Richard Yates, and It's a Wonderful Life. The idea of the town that really is, you know, it's we're all making it. We're all making Claremont feel that way, willingly, for the good schools, for the cozy, safe streets, and the pleasant restaurants. And yet we're swimming in a desert of the real, as Baudrillard would put it. The drought, you know, you're in this. Among other things, this place is a botanical fiction. Mm. The green, the tall trees, the shady trees. You know, you just drive literally across the dividing line to upland, and suddenly you're in flat yellow desert. Mm. And the water that's poured into this locality to keep the fiction alive that we're really in a Connecticut suburb, you know, that we're really in Williamstown, Massachusetts or something. So this is a really interesting subject, potentially, that does actually interface with things I've thought about my whole life. Would I have known that Claremont existed if I hadn't taken this job? No. But its reality field is quite specific, and yeah, I could conceivably make something of that.
I'm feeling a rich paranoia about it already.
Good. There you go.
Do we all live in a reality field?
According to Jonathan Lethem, I think we live in each our own reality field, and it interacts with the fields of the places we live in and so on. You know, he's got a worldview you always want to hear more of. I don't know if you're a fan of his.
But oh, absolutely.
We all, yeah. I guess, probably are.
Yes, we are.
Do you have animals in your reality field?
I'm afraid I don't have any animals. I'm allergic to cats.
That's that. Laurie thinks of that as hell on earth.
This interview just ended, I think.
I don't not want a cat.
But... Laurie dropped the mic and walked out. The rest of this interview is on the LARB website under LARB AV, and as are the other 59 or 62 or however many of them there are. We look forward to his next dispatch from Korea shortly.
That was Colin Marshall talking about Jonathan Lethem. You can check out what Colin's been up to on the Korea blog on LARB, LAReviewOfBooks.org. I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Laurie Weiner. You are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK. Our next guest is Sam Quiñones. He's a journalist, an author. He's written for the New York Times, National Geographic. You worked at the Los Angeles Times for a long time, didn't you?
10 years.
Your new book is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam, welcome to the Los Angeles Review of Books Radio Hour.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So my first question is, there's a heroin epidemic. 20 years ago, there wasn't. How do we get to where we are?
Well, that's about the first half of the book, actually. It starts with a revolution, really, in U.S. medicine. This is the first drug scourge since the end of World War II, really, that did not start with drug gangs or the mafia or the underworld in some sense. This starts really with mainstream U.S. legitimate medical doctors and the pharmaceutical industry that, along with certain pain specialists, convinced most doctors in America that America was, number one, facing an epidemic of pain, and that, number two, the best way to treat that was through narcotic pain pills, pills that people would probably recognize, like Vicodin and Percocet, and then later OxyContin, and that these pills were now known to be virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. This was something for which there was no scientific basis, this idea that these pills were virtually non-addictive. Nevertheless, because of a variety of factors at work in American society, they were able to convince doctors from Washington State to Florida to Hawaii to Maine that this was the case, and that they could now, with good conscience, prescribe these pills for not just dying cancer patients, which was kind of like almost accepted at that point, but for all manner of pain, post-surgery, and not just post-surgery, a couple of pills, but post-surgery, you take home bottles of 60 Vicodin or 90 Percocets or whatever it is, extraction of wisdom teeth, a variety of chronic pain, a lot of chronic pain. And what we ended up having was, over a 20-year period, because there are so many more doctors than there are drug traffickers in America, an enormous kind of rising sea level of pain pills all across the country. The crucial fact is that these pills are molecularly, chemically, almost identical to heroin. The same euphoria, the same effect on the brain chemistry, and the same withdrawal symptoms, except for that they cost, on the street, they cost a dollar a milligram, and you can very easily get up to, when your tolerance rises after you begin to abuse them, a daily dosage of 150, 200 milligrams a day of these pills. Exactly. And they, contrary to what the message was, many people found that these pills were addictive.
And so when does this OxyContin, the kind of street OxyContin, when does that start?
OxyContin comes out in 1996. It is the classic drug. It's really a game changer in several ways. Number one, it is promoted by the company that makes it, Purdue Pharma, a privately held firm that up to that point was really known mainly for a laxative, a minor laxative. It was a minor player in the pharmaceutical industry. Because there are really no guidelines on how to promote and market these things, it begins to promote these pills as if they were almost over-the-counter medicine. Two doctors, the salespeople were going out with floppy hats, saying like OxyContin, phone pads, pill boxes. They had a CD called Swing in the Right Direction with OxyContin. It was with Count Basie and Benny Goodman tunes. And these were the years. This was 96 and then late 90s and into the 2000s. These were years when the pharmaceutical industry was really gripped by a sales force arms race.
Right.
So every company had to hire more and more and more people, you know. What happens, though, is that very quickly it's learned on the street that you can abuse these things. Plus, this is the bridge. OxyContin is the bridge between the smaller pain pills like Vicodin, 10 milligram Vicodin, which had acetaminophen in it, or Percocet, which had Tylenol, or something like that.
Between, which were not much fun.
Right. You could not easily abuse them because your liver would just, you know, get corroded and this kind of thing. So OxyContin has just a big whack of dope, 40 milligrams, 80 milligrams. For a while, they had 160 milligrams. It provides the bridge between these smaller pills and heroin. All our heroin now comes from Mexico or Colombia, so it's very cheap. All of a sudden, heroin is like, as many people told me, a quote-unquote no-brainer. And the switch to heroin takes place. It's happened hundreds of thousands of times, maybe millions of times all across the country.
What was the epidemic of pain that you referred to? What was that about?
Yeah, what's that argument?
It was postulated by several pain specialists who in the 80s were interns and residents, young doctors, and they were shaped really by the ethos that was then in place, which was we don't prescribe these pills for anybody. American doctors really never prescribed these pills except under the most scrutinized situations because they were afraid of addiction. These doctors saw people dying in utter, inhumane, indecent agony over and over again when these pills would have solved their pain. They were kind of formed by that. That was their, and they became almost like revolutionaries. I think there's a lot of parallels between them and say some of the Bolshevik revolutionaries in the around the time of Tsarist Russia. You know, where they just saw one goal and the ends kind of justified the means, and nothing else really mattered. They had been seared by too many patients dying, screaming in agony, and this is really the way it was for decades and decades. They won the argument pretty easily that we ought to be prescribing these things for dying cancer patients. It didn't make any sense if a person had 3 months to live to care if he was going to be die addicted. The main thing was that you needed to take care of his pain so he could live the last 3 months in some kind of humane, you know, situation. That then carried over, and that pendulum never stopped swinging once it got pushed, and it just went all the way to the far, far extreme, which is where we are now.
For much of the 20th century, heroin had a very skanky reputation. It was a street drug. It was not a middle-class drug. You could do all the drugs in the world, but you wouldn't do heroin, was kind of the ethos of mid-century America. What occurred socially to allow heroin to be acceptable to that cohort?
Pills happened. They had pharmaceutical markings on them, prescribed by doctors, looked clean. So you got away from that whole skanky back alley, skid row, under the overpass kind of image that had built up around it.
Panic in Needle Park.
Exactly. All of that stuff just doesn't even apply. Nobody gets into these pills thinking they're going to be a heroin addict eventually. Nobody just says, I'm going to just start being a heroin addict, of course. But the pills are the gateway. They kind of melt that. And an opiate addiction, it turns out, is a horrible bastard of a slavery kind of that you enter into. And all that you intended very quickly kind of goes by the wayside as you just seek out more and more dope. And eventually, yeah, the switch to heroin is not that hard to make after you're shooting up OxyContin, because that's the only way to satisfy your tolerance after you've been getting high for 6 to 9 months.
And I don't think people realize how large an epidemic this is. There are now more overdose deaths than traffic fatalities.
Yes, that's an amazing, I write about that in my book. I chart that as the moment when two epidemiologists in the state of Ohio figure out you've had traffic accidents have been the leading cause of accidental death in America. And now, 2007 in Ohio, that's about to change. And then the next year, it changed for the entire country. But I talked to the two epidemiologists who kind of just were crunching numbers. One guy in particular, fascinating guy. One of the things I try to do in the book is to kind of make sexy these very obscure jobs. And this guy was like in a little cubicle just crunching numbers for the Department of Health for the state of Ohio. But he was a really dogged guy. He didn't give up. And he began to notice all these poisonings for the state of Ohio on the rise. Well, poisonings are always stable from year to year. There's like 200-300. But within poisonings are counted also drug overdoses. And he begins to figure out that, gee, there's a whole bunch of these drug. Why is that? Why? Because we've never had a rise in drug overdoses since the 70s, since the last time heroin was important, you know?
You're known as a writer about Mexico. You lived in Mexico for many years, and you've written a couple of books about Mexico. And there's a Mexican angle to this story as well.
Entirely. I really backed into this story. Most people that I talk to, they start with the pills, charting the pills, and then it gets to eventually heroin. Maybe my advantage in all this was, I lived in Mexico for 10 years. I wrote two books. I knew Mexican villages, ranchos in Mexico very, very well. And I could kind of recognize trends maybe that other people might not have seen. I really got into this story because I was wondering, why is it that so many Mexican heroin traffickers are doing such good business? I didn't know a thing about the pain revolution. I didn't really know what OxyContin was or Vicodin. I'd lived in Mexico when all that pain revolution was underway. What I wanted to know was why it was that they were able to sell black tar heroin, which is only in this hemisphere made in Mexico, why they were selling so much black tar heroin in West Virginia, of all places. West Virginia has no Mexicans. It's got the lowest percentage of foreign-born people in of any state in America.
No kidding.
And yes, and so why would there be black tar heroin over a sustained period of time in doses and potency large enough to kill a dozen people in 6 months in a town that had never had a heroin overdose really up to then in 10 years? All of that is what kind of got me going. And it was there that I found the other kind of big story that's in the book, which is about the town that sells, retails heroin up here like pizza.
All right, the new book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam Quiñones, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks to David Shields.
Always a great guest.
Love having David Shields on. That guy loves to argue.
He does.
It's fantastic.
He's a debater.
Thanks to Sam Quiñones, Colin Marshall, and Jonathan Latham. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin.
Also a debater.
Our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano. Czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, and of course the irreplaceable Sid Biggs, without whom we could not do this show.
Love you, Sid.
We also couldn't do the show without the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. We'd like to thank them. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is good. You can write a review, something that might begin with, "Lori is fabulous, Tom is cool, but what I really love about the LARB Radio Hour is dot, dot, dot." You can fill out the rest. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. You've been listening to the LARB Radio Hour. We will see you next week.